Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. A story about a premature and tragic death to cancer, another about the slow and sad decline of a New England way of life, and a man weeping. That's right, we must be talking about the final days of the race for governor of Massachusetts. In last night's debate between the Democratic Attorney General Martha Coakley and Republican Charlie Baker, the candidates traded views and punches on jobs, taxes, immigration, paid sick leave, and ethical lapses. But the question and answer that made front page news was when a reporter asked them about the last time they cried. An emotional Baker owned that moment when he told a story about meeting a fisherman in New Bedford who said he has two sons who had hoped to go to college rather than become fishermen.
They were both spectacular football players at New Bedford High School who were given college scholarships to go play football. And I told them no. I said, you're going to be fishermen. I was a fisherman. My brothers were fishermen. My father was a fisherman. You're going to be fishermen. And I ruined their lives.
We'll speak with Charlie Baker in a moment. But first, our own Bob Oakes. Of course, he's the host of WBUR's Morning Edition, and he helped moderate last night's gubernatorial debate. And Bob, thanks for being here.
Hi, Anthony.
So, Bob, a lot of important issues came up last night, but I have to ask you about Charlie Baker's tears, which became the front page story, for better or for worse. Some have wondered, were they for real, or was it staged for political effect? You were right beside him. What do you think?
Well, first off, I have to say, I think both of these candidates are pretty exhausted. Sitting up close, you could see Baker's face and his eyes change at that moment. So, in my opinion, they were very, very genuine.
Well, here's what I woke up thinking about. Once upon a time, a candidate shedding tears on the campaign trail was akin to political death. I mean, I'm thinking back to presidential candidate Ed Muskie, who became emotional in New Hampshire with regard to questions about his wife. It wasn't even clear if he was actually crying, but even the suggestion hurt his candidacy. So what's going on today when we invite candidates to become emotional and they oblige and we seem to welcome it, to want it? What's going on in your view?
Well, I think it's a little bit of gotcha journalism, but I also think in a lot of cases it's simply fair game, and in some cases it's spontaneous. Baker has had a reputation during this campaign of being a technocrat. Coakley had a reputation of being aloof. So last night with that question, when we sat in a room before the debate and crafted that question, the idea was simply to get them to show a slice of their human side. And I certainly think we got that from both the candidates last night. And I have to say, in this campaign, I think that is fair game.
Well, as we mentioned, Bob, Martha Coakley and Charlie Baker talked about a lot of other issues. What stood out to you in last night's debate? And how do you think that final debate helped or hurt Baker and Coakley?
Well, let me answer it this way. I think that there is still at least a question or two hanging out there for both of these candidates that they would do well to answer if they can in the final few days. Baker still can't answer the question about why he won't call for the release of the report into the New Jersey investigation over his $10,000 donation to New Jersey Republicans and subsequent awarding of a company he worked for, which got a big fat New Jersey pension contract. To some voters, I have to think that they're saying to themselves, why not just ask for it? Doesn't make any sense not to.
Just say release it. Put it on the table. Let the cards fall where they may.
Exactly. The New Jersey officials can always say, yeah, we're ignoring him. But that's okay. Then he's at least asked for it. And on Martha Coakley, the question of whether she will raise taxes and fees as governor clearly still sits on her shoulders. You know, she joked last night when asked about whether she would raise fees, when she said, if Charlie Baker won't raise them, then neither will I. The joke completely fell flat. What a mistake with a capital M.
Well, that's WBUR's Bob Oakes, who was one of the moderators of last night's gubernatorial debate. Bob, thanks so much for sticking around, and go home and get some sleep.
Thanks, Anthony.
And a little while ago, we talked to Charlie Baker right here in our studios. And the first question we asked him was about that pay-to-play allegation that Bob mentioned. We asked him, why not push for total transparency and simply ask New Jersey Governor Chris Christie to release the report into the allegations and be done with it?
Well, I think I have pushed for total transparency on this one. I've released my tax returns. I hired the former general counsel of the Federal Election Commission to do a review of all of the documentation associated with this, including a review of the New Jersey law. And he issued a 15-page, pretty detailed report outlining all the facts of the case. And his conclusion was that I didn't need to take corrective action.
No, and I understand
that. So as far as I'm concerned, if somebody with those credentials and that background, based on a review of the documents, believes I don't need to take corrective action, as far as I'm concerned, the issue is resolved.
Well, it's resolved, but there's a report there that hasn't been released. So why not just say, even if New Jersey doesn't release it, you can just say, hey, release it. Let's be totally transparent.
I'm sure the people in New Jersey will release the report when it's ready to be released, whenever that might be. I mean, the pension system in New Jersey has been conducting this investigation, and I'm sure they'll release the report when it's finished.
All right. Well, I have to ask you about this big emotional moment in last night's debate when you choked up telling a story about a family of New Bedford fishermen. The story was about a fisherman whose sons both went into business instead of college, a decision that the father said ruined their lives. But here's the question. There are a lot of fishermen dealing with the changing economy. So what would a Governor Baker do to help them?
Well, one of the things I don't think Massachusetts has done a good job of is actually doing some analytic around what's happening out in the water. I talked about this last night. You know, UMass Dartmouth has a terrific marine sciences program, and MIT has some people who've developed some incredibly powerful tools that have been written about for doing underwater scope and investigation. And I think the Commonwealth should engage UMass Dartmouth and others and find out what's going on out there in the water. Because at this point in time, the federal government makes its decisions on everything associated with catch shares and all the rest, and how much people can fish and all that, based on what I would describe as a pretty random and haphazard approach to figuring this out.
But they are
the only source of information with respect to how to make this call. At this point in time, I think we've sort of never really bothered to engage on the fundamental question, which is what's happening with the fish out there.
But we've been hearing for a long time, I mean, it may be primarily sponsored by the federal government, but we've had a lot of knowledgeable people counting fish stocks for a long, long time saying that they are in serious, serious trouble. You know, I'm thinking of this fisherman that you described in the debate last night. Wouldn't your job as governor be to tell him the hard truth, hard as it is, that there just aren't enough fish to sustain the industry at current levels?
Well, but that's exactly my point, which is we haven't tried to figure out the answer to that question. And shame on the Commonwealth with respect to that.
Those fishermen aren't the only vulnerable folks in this state, many of whom rely on public assistance of one kind or another, and many who are in big financial trouble over circumstances beyond their control. So you've called for welfare reform, and I want to ask you a little bit about this. Your critics have a hard time seeing how welfare reform, cutting the social safety net, could help people in need, would help people in need.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think most people on public assistance would rather be on public assistance or would rather be working?
Well, I mean, the answer to that is obviously they'd rather be working.
But right. I think, too.
But part of the answer is also some people need the public assistance through no fault of their own.
I don't disagree with that either. But that's what makes programs like the one that Ray Mariano, a Democrat, former mayor of Worcester, the guy who runs the public housing authority out there, started. And the program was built on this idea that he wanted to help people find their way out of public housing and off public assistance. And I've met with a lot of the folks who've gone through his program, and their stories are incredibly compelling. But for most of them, they needed somebody to help them figure this out. And one of the great things about the way Ray runs that program is he gives every person who's involved in that program a mentor, an advisor, a case manager, whatever it is you want to call it, somebody who can help them build a plan and then help them follow through and execute on that plan. And I don't think it's particularly compassionate to just send people a check or whatever it happens to be and do nothing to help them figure out a way to find their way off dependency. Mm. And, you know, when you talk to some of the folks like Ray, who've been in this business for a long time, he's got 4 and 5 generations that have been living in Worcester Public Housing. And he thinks That's too bad, and I agree with them. And I think we should be trying to come up with strategies and programs, especially ones that work, to try to help people find their way to self-sufficiency.
Well, let me ask you about the what might be described as the flip side of this conversation. On the one hand, there's welfare reform. Other folks will talk about the need to reform welfare for the rich and corporations. And let me just read you two statistics. So the New York Times did a study that found state and local governments provide at least $80 billion in subsidies to corporations. Here's one more example from the Boston Globe. They analyzed the emergency tax legislation passed by Congress in early 2013 and found that it contained 43 business and energy tax breaks, together worth $67 billion. So the question is, isn't welfare sort of an easy target? And would a Governor Baker also look at these other kinds of welfare?
Governor Patrick has made a significant decision to invest in clean tech and green energy and provided a significant amount of tax support for solar, for wind, for hydro, and for other alternatives to fossil-based fuels to generate electricity and energy. I would assume that most of those kinds of tax breaks and tax incentives are things that many people in Massachusetts like and would like to see Massachusetts continue to do, because their values are such that they think that's an appropriate thing for government to support as people try to build that kind of industry. So my view on this stuff is you got to be willing to view all of these in the larger context. And I've said several times during this campaign that I think we ought to look at all of the tax expenditures that are out there, at least on a biannual basis. But to say that, you know, every tax break is a bad idea would mean that a lot of the tax breaks, frankly, that many people on the left like would have to come off the table as well.
Let me ask you about taxes and fees. You said that you would not raise fees in lieu of raising taxes. This came up last night. But isn't that, in a way, limiting the options you'll have as governor? You're intent on keeping the state's budget in good balance. What if there's another economic downturn?
One of the things we should continue to do is to build up the state's rainy day fund, which did come up last night. We talked about for a few minutes. I think the last two recessions, in fact, the fact that we had more than $2 billion in our rainy day fund ended up being a big asset to the Commonwealth as it dealt with that downturn. But I also, I mean, every single day when I'm out there campaigning, especially in working class neighborhoods, the thing I hear over and over again from those people is that they really feel they just get nickel and dime to death by the Commonwealth, whether it's registry fees or satellite TV taxes or the gas tax increase, which most of them know is now slated to go up automatically every year forever. Many of them live pretty far away from where they work because the price of housing required them to live pretty far away from the place where they work. They drive, you know, many of them drive 50, 60 miles each way to get to and from work. The idea that the gas tax just goes up forever is a problem for them. They're looking at a monstrous increase in their costs of electricity and energy because we didn't do the work we should have done as a Commonwealth to expand our existing natural gas pipelines. I mean, they have a lot of things to be grumpy about, and I want to give them a state government that stretches a buck the same way they do.
But there's also sort of an element of reality here, and let me ask you about decoupling the gas tax from inflation. I mean, that means that the gas tax essentially loses its purchasing power over time. So what about maintaining roads and bridges and public transportation? Why is that a good idea?
Well, I didn't oppose raising the gas tax.
But I do
oppose the idea that it should just go up forever without any legislator ever having to vote on it. I think, as I said in the debate in Worcester on Monday night, I think representative democracy is about representative democracy, which means if the legislature wants to raise a tax, they should vote to raise the tax, make the case to the voters in their community, and then let the voters make the call on whether they support that or not. And in my economic development plan, I've proposed creating what I call a state of good repair fund, which we would put $25 million in the first year, $50 million in the second year, $75 million in the third year, and $100 million in the fourth year to pay for the state of good repair, basic repair work that we should be paying for out of the operating budget in the first place to support our infrastructure needs. It bothers me that we borrow 20 and 30 year debt to pay for practically everything we do in transportation, including a lot of stuff that really ought to be paid for out of the operating budget. And I think we need to get into the habit of putting money into the operating budget to support those kinds of initiatives, because that's really where it belongs.
But don't a lot of taxes go up without a vote of the legislature? I mean, property taxes go up. All kinds of taxes go up without a vote every single time.
Well, but the deal there on the property tax is you have a property tax that goes that can't go up any more than 2.5% a year. There's a cap on it, and that cap is defined by state law.
Charlie, I want to come back, if I can, to this emotional moment in last night's debate. And we heard Bob Oakes a moment ago talking about the sheer exhaustion of this process that you and Martha Coakley yeah. must both be dealing with.
The question we got asked was, when was the last time you cried? And I told this story over the weekend and couldn't get through it. And I worried that I wouldn't get through it last night.
Right,
and I didn't.
Don't start now.
I won't start now. But I mean, let's face it. It's my wife a couple of weeks ago said, I don't even know what day it is anymore. And I said, it's just today, honey, you know, and it's just going to be today for the next few weeks.
So final question, at the risk of probing the personal side again, win or lose, when this campaign is finally over, which is only a few days away,
yeah.
what does Charlie Baker do to unwind? What's the first thing you want to do?
I haven't thought about that at all. I can tell you the first thing I'd like to do is not get up in the morning and shave. That would be a great thing. I'd like to not get up in the morning in the dark. That would be a really good thing. My wife and I are going to get out of town for a few days sometime in the middle of the month after some of my kids' sports seasons end. And we're going to go spend 5 days just lying somewhere and not doing much and reading a few books. I like to read, and I have a lot of books that have stacked up that I haven't touched. And
what's on top of that pile?
They're calling to me.
What's the book that calls to you most?
I read a book called Lone Survivor, which was written by Marcus Luttrell. He actually wrote it down on the Cape. It was a story about it was the biggest single loss of life in the history of the Navy SEAL program. And he wrote a follow-up to that called Service, which I would really like to read.
All right. Well, Charlie Baker, Republican candidate for the governor of Massachusetts, thank you for coming in today, and good luck the rest of the campaign.
Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
And by the way, we have extended an invitation to Democrat Martha Coakley. We hope and expect to have her on the program later this week. Stay with us. Coming up, it's hip, it's happening, it's where to be, but where's the next Somerville? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.